Hey guys, you're listening to Drunk and Uncultured.
We are a drinking problem masquerading as a pop culture podcast.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Stephanie. And I have a very bad cold, so ignore me while I sound like this today. So it is
the second episode.
Second episode of March. But because we were joined by Charlotte last episode, we did not talk about my album highlights. So, real quick, I just want to run through my five favorite albums that came out in February. It's a delayed Stephanie's Music Corner.
Mm-hmm.
First one came out on February 2nd. It is The Last Dinner Party and their album Prelude to Ecstasy. I'm obsessed with this band. I cannot stop listening to them. I think this album is so fucking good, and they're, like, blowing up in popularity right now.
Yeah, you've been listening to them a lot.
They have this kind of like expansive sound a little bit, where it's very femme forward rock, but it's got this, like, it's just such a big sound.
Mm-hmm.
Some of what they do kind of reminds me of Sparks in the early years, like when they were starting out in the 60s. But it's, I think they're fantastic, and I cannot wait to see them at Lolla this year. I gave it a 9. It was so fucking good. The next one came out, well, the next three all came out on February 9th. The first one being the second album by Brittany Howard. Her album is called What Now? Brittany Howard, famously the lead singer of the Alabama Shakes, the very popular indie band. She has been making some solo music for a while. Her first album was a little more like Americana sounding, a little bit more grounded. This album is just so funky and kind of out there. She created a very different artistic vibe in this album, which I really enjoy. One of the coolest things she does in this album is between songs, she uses like medicine bowls. So it's meant to be like a cleansing experience when you listen to the album between tracks.
Okay.
It's just so artsy and weird, and I fucking love it. And she's going to be so damn good at Pitchfork. So excited. I gave it a 10. It was a phenomenal album. When I went to go buy the physical copy, Steve was very upset because they put it under Alabama Shakes. Mm-hmm. And he's like, she is a solo artist. How dare you lump her in like this? I was like, Steve, the smile is under Radiohead, so it's fine.
It's because they don't want to make that many of the bins.
Right. But the next one also came out February 9th. The second album by Ducks Limited called Harm's Way. We were really excited for this one to come out. Yep. I loved their debut album.
I love Ducks Limited.
They're so good. This album, very similar sound to their first album. Very mm-hmm. consistent. Just very, very good.
Yes. Agree. I like that one a lot.
They'll be playing The Empty Bottle in April, and I am very excited. I mostly want to hear the song 18 Cigarettes Live.
Again. I agree.
Yeah. I gave this album a 9.5. It's so good. Next one is Chelsea Wolfe. Her album is called She Who Reaches Out to She Who Reaches Out to She. She's dark, she's moody, she's got this like cool goth vibe going on. Vocally, she's so incredibly talented. Great album. I gave it a 10 because it was so fucking good.
Okay.
I saw her live this past week and she was amazing. Mm-hmm. I had never seen her before. The last one I want to talk about is actually kind of cool. Came out February 16th. Is a band called Freako. They are a local Chicago band. And their debut album is called Where We've Been, Where We Go From Here. It feels like an early 2000s indie album. It's got like this very nostalgic feeling when you mm-hmm. listen to it.
I feel like I've been hearing a lot about them lately.
They just did a Reddit AMA.
Yeah.
Former guest Justin is a big fan of them right now.
Okay.
They're really good. We've got a lot of our friends listening to them right now, so it's fun. It's always fun finding, like, local bands that are this good and talented.
Totally agree.
I gave it a 10. And that was that.
Cool. Alright, let's get into the beer. Steph, what are we drinking?
We are drinking, Panda Party from Forbidden Root. I was at the brewery this week, and I decided to pick this up for us. This is one of the beers they have most of the time year-round at the taproom. It is a black lager with vanilla and toasted oak. They call it toasted marshmallow style.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really good beer. I drink this a lot. But
yeah, it's same.
We haven't done Forbidden Root on the show in a while, so me seeing it at the tap room, I was like, ooh, this will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
It says that it's supposed to evoke the feeling of a campfire. Oh, which it definitely does.
It does. Ah, so good.
It's interesting because it smells so vanilla forward.
I get more of the oak notes when you like drink
when
it.
When you drink it, but you expect it to be really, really vanilla.
You expect it to be way sweeter than it is.
Yeah. It's very crisp. It's got the typical like black lager body.
Yeah, it's thin, but it's, you know, it's got the roasty notes, a little smokiness to it.
Yep.
Almost, I would almost describe it a little bit as like burnt marshmallow is kind of where you get that like woody flavor.
You get a lot of the woodiness. Yeah. It really tastes very oaky, but like in a, not an overwhelming way.
Yeah.
Like it's very oak forward. You get, the marshmallow is just kind of like that pillowy like lightness. It's not sweet by any means.
Agreed. I love this beer. When I actually posted about it on the podcast feed. I tried the mint version of this for St. Paddy's Day, and it's literally just, it tastes like a grasshopper cocktail.
Oh, cool.
It was so fucking good.
That sounds good.
Steve drank like three of them. He was like, this is amazing.
Pounding them.
Yeah.
Cool. You have three words?
I'm gonna do marshmallow, roasty, and I'm gonna say like weedy, because I got that very traditional lager. Mm-hmm. Like lightness, maltiness to it.
Yep. I'm going to say smoky. Malty and roasty.
Smoky and roasty feel a little similar, but I will give you this one.
In my head, like roasty is more of like the coffee side of it. I guess more coffee than anything else.
Yeah.
And smoky to me is like that wood flavor.
Yeah. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Cool. So let's get into the episode.
Yeah, so today we are going to be celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the Grand Budapest Hotel by Wes Anderson. This is just going to end up being just a whole Wes Anderson episode because this is one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies, so I'm just excited to talk about all of his stuff. He is my favorite film director. I am obsessed with him and all of his work.
Yeah, I love Wes Anderson. I'm late to the boat, I think, as a Wes Anderson fan. I was never really, I think the first and only for the longest time that I'd ever seen was Life Aquatic. And then eventually watched like the Darjeeling Limited.
I love that one.
But then when I started dating Matt, Matt's a big Wes Anderson fan.
He might be a bigger Wes Anderson fan than me.
He might be. He loves Wes Anderson.
I know.
When I started dating Matt is when I started to watch a lot more of his movies. Yeah. So we had this kind of like during COVID actually, like, this goal to get through as many of them as we can, as we could. So I ended up watching a lot of Wes Anderson and kind of fell in love with the style as well.
So what was, you said your first Wes Anderson film you saw was The Life Aquatic?
Yeah.
I love that one.
That one's a good one.
That's, I think, Steve's favorite. It's the only one he lets me watch.
I like it. It's not my favorite.
The first one I ever saw was Rushmore. I took a film studies class in high school and we like did an analysis of the movie.
Okay.
So we watched it then, and then immediately after I was like, oh, I have to watch all of this.
Yep.
Cause Fantastic Mr. Fox had just come out.
Okay.
When I was in this class.
I feel like Fantastic Mr. Fox was a big Tumblr.
Yeah.
Content thing. Wes Anderson in general was big on
Tumblr.
But Fantastic Mr. Fox specifically, I think that was like, people had like their personalities built around Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus, I am stuffy today. I think one of the things that makes Wes Anderson's films so unique is obviously his like very distinctive style of directing, where everything almost feels like it's a diorama.
Yeah, I was reading about that, and it's meant to, like, mimic a 2D, dimensional, like, with the camera pans, and the world is meant to look like it's two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional, which I think is a really interesting way
it's a different to approach. Shoot.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so distinctive that, like, when you say Wes Anderson, you can, like, immediately, like, picture the style.
Everything is pastel. It's a lot of,
like, aesthetically, like
panning shots.
Yeah.
Where
proportionate.
The sets like literally it feels like you're, I think the 2D world is like the best way of describing it.
It's like you're watching a movie but reading a book. Yeah. Like a picture book. Yeah. Almost. Which I think is interesting.
I think also what makes it really distinctive is because this, there's like the same actors from film to film.
Yeah.
It almost feels like you're watching an anthology of sorts because it's like you're seeing the same people play different characters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I am reading that he uses like extensive flat space camera moves. So that's like that pan thing.
Yeah.
To make things look two dimensional, and that they also describe his style as Baroque pop. That's not realist or surrealist, but described as fabulous.
Okay.
And then I think the other thing that's fun is like his use of pop music. He uses a lot of 60s and 70s pop music. Yeah. Like Cat Stevens, The Kinks, Beach Boys, Hank Williams, like popular music from the 70s and 60s that it's almost like a juxtaposition in some of the movies where they're so fantastical feeling.
And then you're like grounded with that 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like very popular music that grounds you.
I think the other, I mean, we were talking about like the way he like sets everything up. Like everything is symmetrical.
Uh-huh.
That's, I think, one of like the other like characteristic things is that everything has got this perfect symmetry to it. And that's where...
And perfect, like, shapes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not, like, if you're looking at a building, it's, like, a traditional, like, what you would draw as a kindergartner. Like, it's a square with a roof. It's not, like, typically a weird...
It's also almost got, like, this gray wash to a lot of his stuff, too, where it feels, like, not like a regular film.
It's almost like the people have a gray wash, but then all of the imagery in the background...
is like, this pastel bright color.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I think, what the distinctive thing is. It's like, the sky will be gray, but then there's a pop of color.
Yeah.
And everything else is almost gray washed out.
It's a little bit, like, muted when you look at it all together.
Yeah.
Like, the thing that keeps coming to mind is, and I know it's not the same, but it reminds me of, like, the Vaseline filter from Drag Race.
Okay.
On that first season of Drag Race, where everything is slightly washed out. Yep. Like, that's what a lot of his films kind of evoke to me.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I don't even know what you call that. We just call it the Vaseline filter.
I don't know what that's called.
You know what I'm talking about,
I do, right? Know what you're talking about. And you mentioned the frequent collaborators, and I think this is really funny, or really fun to talk about specifically, because that's, like, I think one of the things that he's noted for.
Yeah.
And it's been happening since, like, you know, his first movie.
Yeah.
Bottle Rocket.
Yeah.
Where he had, you know, Owen and Luke Wilson. Owen and Luke Wilson in that movie, and, you know, both frequent collaborators later.
Yeah.
But it really started from the beginning, and then now he's just kind of known for, like, these mega casts where everybody wants to be in the movie.
There's actually an article I'm looking at right now that it lists all of the actors and, like, the various people that have worked on his films, and it's, like, a checkbox of how many they've been in. And
yeah,
how many they've been in, and I just think it's really interesting that you have so many recurring people that you can, like, do this.
The one I'm seeing as the highest is, oh, that's a music supervisor. He uses the same, like, people too, right?
Yeah. Like, for the most part, it's composers. He's worked with the same producers,
same cinematographer. Yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to find the highest actor number.
I think it's Jason Schwartzman.
You're right. This is like not... Oh, I guess it's an alphabetical order by last name. Jason Schwartzman, 7.
Bill Murray has been in 9. It's the highest. And then it's Jason Schwartzman's been in 7.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, Bill Murray was in...
The only one he's not
Owen Wilson has been in 7 as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's... You got, like, Bill Murray, Jason Schwartzman, Owen Angelica Wilson. Houston, William Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum, Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton. Like, that's kind of...
Frances McDormand.
Yeah. It's like the main people that you think of when you think of these films.
Agree. And I think it's fun because, like, even, like, the new movies that are coming out, like, one just came out this year, and I want to say it had, like, everyone you expect to be in here. So.
Except for Bill Murray. Bill Murray is not in it. It's got everybody else. It's got Tom Hanks, though. That's where they swapped him out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have not seen this new one.
The Wonderful Story of Henry
No, Sugar. That one's not out yet.
That one came out
Asteroid earlier City.
This month.
Oh, it did?
It did, yeah.
I thought Asteroid City was the one that was most recently released.
No, the Henry one came out a week ago.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Damn. Oh, yeah. It just came out. With Benadryl Cucumber Patch, your favorite yes. actor. And Dev Patel.
I love Dev Patel. So let's start talking about his movies.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what we're here for, right?
Yeah.
So I mentioned my first experience was Life Aquatic, and then I think I watched Darjeeling Limited. And then from there, it's when Matt and I started to watch a lot of them. I think the next one I had seen was Bottle Rocket. And then that's when we got into, like, the more traditional, well-known ones. So,
yeah.
Like, Moonrise Kingdom, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Royal Tenenbaums. That one was fantastic. I did not expect.
Royal Tenenbaums?
Yeah.
That's a great movie.
It was weird. Like, and I think that was... I know his movies were weird. I guess Bottle Rock was my first experience of him, like, him just doing some weird shit. Like,
yeah.
Weird concepts.
Yeah, yeah,
But the Royal Tenenbaums, I think, for me, was, like, the real encapsulation of, like, just how strange his stories are.
Yeah, I would say the Royal Tenenbaums is, like, one of the staples that when you think of his work, like, that's typically where people's head goes. If you've been following it for a long time.
And I would say, like, Grand Budapest.
Yeah, Grand Budapest. For people that came on a little bit later, I think it just kind of depends on when you got introduced.
Yep.
And if you were a Tumblr kid, because the Royal Tenenbaums was the Tumblr kids.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I knew I would see a lot of, like, imagery around Grand Budapest Hotel. Granted, I hadn't seen it when it came out. So I remember seeing, like, a lot of people, like, raving about that movie. And, like, the style around it. Because I think that was one of the first big.
Yeah. It's the first one that he got nominated for Best Director.
Okay.
He got an Oscar nom for Best Director and, I think, Best Picture.
That makes sense.
For Grand Budapest.
So for me, I feel like that one's quintessential, but not my favorite.
What is your favorite?
Rushmore.
Oh, we were talking about this earlier.
Yeah, I love Rushmore. There's something
cringy.
I know, and there's something about how cringy it is, and, like, knowing that, like, at the time it wasn't cringy, but, like, now it is. Right? And then seeing, like, young Jason Schwartzman is interesting. The whole storyline's fucking weird.
Yeah.
And I just think it's funny. Like, it's a weird concept, and it's, you know, the second movie he did, and Bottle Rock, also a weird concept. But this is, I feel like, where he really kind of leaned into, like, the absurdism.
Yeah.
Of storytelling. And, like, the concept of Rushmore and, like, Jason Schwartzman being, like, a student and, like going to war essentially with Bill Murray is just so fun to me.
Yeah.
Like, some of the dialogue is cringy, but some of it also, like, is still, like, repeated to this day. Like, the line, "I save Latin, what did you ever do?" I hear people quoting that every now and then. And it's funny because I didn't see Rushmore until, like, maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And there were all these lines I just didn't know came from that movie. Like, there's a Fall Out Boy song named after a line.
Yes, I did know that.
Which, like, would never be okay to say today, but... Because it's a slur.
Oh. Which one are we talking about?
The line, "Tell that Mick, he just made my list of things to do today."
Yeah.
I think Mick is technically a slur against, like, Irish people.
It is.
But it's a Fall Out Boy song, too, now.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that until I saw that movie, and I was like, that's where they got it.
Yeah. My favorite is Grand Budapest. I think Ralph Fiennes does such a fucking good job that, like, he's so good in that
movie. Ralph Fiennes is in the new.
Yeah.
The one that just came out.
Yeah.
which I think will be interesting. I want to see it. That would be my first opportunity to see one of the, well, I guess I could have seen Asteroid City in the theater, but I didn't.
The first one I ever saw in theaters was Moonrise Kingdom.
Okay. Grand Budapest is fun, though.
The plot line is so absurd. And, it's just so much, it's like the fantastical side of things. Like, it's just a big fucking story.
And there's something about, like, when he is following a character in a single, like, camera.
Yeah.
And, like, they're running around. Yeah, there's something so fun about the way he shoots. Because he does that in Grand Budapest. He does it in Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah.
He does it sort of in Asteroid City. He does it in the Darjeeling Limited. Like, the single camera following someone and they're like running around, but like it's still done in such an aesthetically pleasing way.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's just, there's, it's so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I love it.
I do too. Yeah. I feel like I could, so I say Rushmore's my favorite, and I really do think it is, but there's something I enjoy about all of them. They all kind of scratch a different itch.
Yeah.
Like, the Darjeeling Limited for me is, like, one of my favorite that Owen Wilson was in. And I don't know. Yeah, it's, like, what, it's because he's just so, like, outlandish.
Yeah.
Especially in that one. I want to say Bottle Rocket is, like, one of the first times he said, wow.
Wow.
If you, like, go back to him, it's, like, one of the first times that they caught him going, wow. And then he also produced this movie called The Squid and the Whale. I don't know if you've seen it. It was directed by Noah Baumbach, who is, I believe, Greta Gerwig's partner.
Yeah, I think they're married now.
I think you might be right.
He's the one that A Marriage Story is about, because he's where Adam Driver
also Madagascar.
Yeah, he made the entire premise of A Marriage Story is that he's like working on this big epic thing, and that's what's taking over his life. And if you think about it, it's fucking Madagascar. He had to work on Madagascar 3 to pay for his divorce.
But The Squid and the Whale, as a producer, was a good movie. It was very fun. And then he has some new ones coming out, but, I wanted to talk about Asteroid City.
Yeah.
Real quick.
Yeah.
I know you haven't seen it, but I feel like that one was one of, like, for me, at least, like, being aware of it, like, highly anticipated movies, because it was probably the biggest,
I think, star-studded cast
that he had to date, with, like, Jason Schwartzman, Scarlett Johansson, Tom Hanks, Jeffrey Wright, Tilda Swinton, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Maya Hawke, Steve Carell, Willem Dafoe, Margot Robbie, and Jeff Goldblum, and, like, some other people I didn't know. And it's like, really, like, highly regarded. I think it's a weird fucking movie.
Didn't you say Esquire ranked it as their number one Wes Anderson film?
That was number one, then they ranked Rushmore number two, and then Grand Budapest Hotel number three.
That's telling me that we have good choices in,
Can you say that again?
Good choices?
Good choices.
We have good choices. In, Wes Anderson films.
Yeah, it's just a really, and they say that they ranked it number one because it's a movie about trying to find the meaning in life, and as the movie, like, doesn't search, the movie itself does not search for any meaning. Mm-hmm. It's done in a really interesting style to me because it's a story within a story.
Okay.
Which is sort of how French Dispatch is told.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's interesting because it's set like as a real world.
Okay.
And the real world is being like narrated by Edward Norton.
Yeah.
And he's like writing a play, and there's characters that are in the real world that are then like acting in Asteroid City.
Okay.
So, like, you see Scarlett Johansson, I want to say, like, in the regular world, and then you also see her as, like, an actress.
Oh,
and playing the part. So, like, the way it's shot is the Edward Norton, like, his piece, and, like, when they're talking about the real world and the guy that's writing the play. It's shot in a different color. I think it's, like, black and white-ish. Or, like, it's a muted tone.
Yeah.
And then they go into the Asteroid City, which is the play.
Uh-huh.
And then that's set in, like, or colored, like, a typical Wes Anderson movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I gotta see this. It's a really interesting concept. It's, like, kind of confusing. And then it just goes off the rails. Like, Jeff Goldblum plays an alien. And there's...
Oh, my man!
There's points now where I was watching and I was like, what is happening? Like, I cannot... I've lost the plot, but, like, it's almost like you don't care. And I think that's why it's, like, regarded so highly, because it's just, like, things are just happening. And you're like, what is happening? And how does this all relate to each other? And I think that's, like, the part that's interesting.
Yeah, I gotta watch this. It sounds good.
It's so long. Weird. It's a very weird movie. It's also really long. I think it's on HBO.
Oh, okay.
I think most of his movies are on HBO.
I think so.
It's a really long movie, and like I said, you'll like, there's gonna be points where you're like, why is this relevant?
Yeah.
And then it, like, some of it doesn't get explained. Like, the cameo with Jeff Goldblum still makes no sense to me to this day. But it's fun.
Yeah.
And that's why it's enjoyable. Yeah. It's just fun. And I think the point there is, like, some things don't have to have meaning.
Yeah. And that's what that Esquire article said.
It's just, sometimes it's just a fun movie, and that's, I think, why people really like it.
There is a flow chart of the relation to everyone in the Royal Tenenbaums that I found.
Oh, cool.
Like, that's helpful.
That is really helpful, because it is confusing.
There's so many freaking people in this movie.
Is that the one where, like, there was a brother in love with a sister?
Yes.
Okay. And then he, like, goes off to live on a ship?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought. Strange movie.
It's a great movie.
I think what I really enjoy about Royal Tenenbaums is, like, they're all, like, prodigies.
Yeah.
And then they grow up to be disaster human beings and, like, regular people. And I think that's so relatable to, like, how, like, as a child, like, you're lauded for being good at things, and then it just, like, can be a car wreck.
Yeah.
Car wreck in real life.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting.
We were talking about how, like, Moonrise Kingdom was the first one I saw in theaters. I was obsessed with this movie mm-hmm. when it first came out, when I was in college.
Moonrise Kingdom?
Yeah. I was a freshman in college. Would have been going into my sophomore year. But it's, like, the whole, like, camp vibe of it is just so entertaining.
I think it's, yeah, it's a fun...
It's a fun story.
Yeah. And I think the aesthetic of it is really fun because it's got all that camp.
Yeah, and because it's got the kids, it's got, like, a slightly different...
And
it feels like a younger target than, like, Darjeeling Limited or something.
And I think part of it is, like, because it's kids, the whole aesthetic feels more magical.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense, because they're children, that, like, there's so much, like, what feels like magic going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally get that. I'm looking at a list of, like, the top 10 quotes on Collider.
Okay.
Number 5 is from the Darjeeling Limited. And it's the line, "I wonder if the three of us would have been friends in real life. Not as brothers, but as people." The delivery of that line was so good. I think that's another reason I like Darjeeling Limited, too, is, and this article kind of brings it up, it feels like a road trip movie.
Yeah, a little bit.
And those are always fun when, like, people are just kind of isolated and by themselves and, like, bonding.
Yeah.
And that's really, like, kind of what it is. It's, like, the bonding and, like, brotherhood, sibling.
Yeah, that movie's really entertaining.
Apparently, Wes Anderson, or, The Life Aquatic is considered one of Wes Anderson's most divisive films.
Why? It's great.
Because people don't like it. And why? People really like it and people don't like it.
Hold on. I'm going to go on Reddit and see why people don't like. Why do people not like The Life Aquatic?
While you do that, I'm going to look up Wes Anderson's Metacritic scores.
Critics hated it, is what I can see. They say that the pacing of the film is off. Critics have made the film seem like it's absolutely terrible. The top comment is, "Critics are morons. I had no idea it was reviewed so poorly until recently."
So Metacritic has his movies listed out by score.
Okay.
The highest rated movie that he produced and wrote and directed was Grand Budapest Hotel at 88. And then Rushmore for 87. And then the new one, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, is 85.
Is there a trailer for this? I feel like I need to watch this.
I don't know much about it either.
To YouTube.
And then Moonrise Kingdom is 84. Fantastic Mr. Fox is 83. Most of his movies, with like, so Asteroid City and French Dispatch are not in the
80s. What is this movie called?
The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar and Three Others. It's like three, it's like four Roald Dahl.
Oh, all right. I found it. Let's watch. It says it's not going to be on Netflix until September.
Oof.
So we gotta That's why I think, I was like, I didn't realize it came out, because I don't think it's widely released yet.
Is it a Netflix?
Is
it not going to be in theater?
I don't know. So, The Wonderful World of Henry Sugar already came out. It came out last year. It started streaming on Netflix in September of 2023.
Oh, it won.
It won an Oscar. Yeah.
I'm so confused.
So, I think they were released as individual
shorts
and, now they're coming together as a whole thing.
Interesting. So, we just watched the trailer for Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. And I completely forgot, and we didn't talk about this, but I think one of the other iconic things about Wes Anderson's style is the moving sets.
Yeah.
So we didn't talk about, like, the sets themselves, like, build in his movie, right? Like, so somebody will walk out of something, and then, like, things will, like, close and change around them to, like, make
That's
a wall.
That's a newer thing, I think, when he tries to, like, expand on the fantasticalness of the films. Like, some of that stuff didn't necessarily happen until later.
It happens a lot in French Dispatch, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And then the moving sets definitely happens in, like, Grand Budapest Hotel.
It does.
Obviously doesn't happen in, like, in the movies that are set in, like, the real world. Yeah. So, like, Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, like, Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah.
I think they do it in Royal Tenenbaums a little bit. And then, like, Darjeeling Limited.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen as much, but, like, the ones that are more fantastical in nature, more, like, fabulous, as they call them, they have that moving set component, and I think it's so much fun, because it's like, sometimes I'll watch the movies and be like, how did they do this? And then the other fun thing that we didn't talk about are, like, and I feel like most movies of his have this, but, like, some kind of driving scene where there is very much a screen in the background as the car is moving.
That are like a running or a biking.
Yes.
Or there's, like, some sort of,
like, movement.
Transportation.
Right. And the person is 100% on, like, a treadmill. And you know it when you're watching it.
That's what we were talking about, the stylistic of the movement of the people in the films.
And it's so fun because it's still got that two-dimensional piece.
Yeah.
Where it's, like, it feels like a closed set. It feels like you're playing with dolls or in a diorama.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, again, one of the more iconic, like, style choices that he makes. I was reading this article about how, because he's so specific in the style and it's so synonymous with his name, people refer to him as, like, an auteur, I think is how you say it, which is just, like, a savant.
Oh.
Like, it's like an artistic savant.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like he doesn't just make movies. Like, they consider it, like, art.
Yeah.
And, like, it's a form of art.
Well, you know that people, like, being a Wes Anderson fan, like, is looked down upon by some people, because it's like being a Quentin Tarantino fan.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a certain type of person that is into this stuff.
And they're obsessive.
And they're obnoxious.
Yes. I get it. And I think it's fine.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be obsessive about it, but I think, like, it's fun to, like,
I love it.
Watch.
The thing, I know what I've been trying, like, how do I want to explain this? Everything feels very indie twee.
Yes.
That's what I was trying, like, what, there's a way that I'm trying to describe how this feels. That, like, twee style. Like, that's what I think of.
Yeah, I don't
think Zoe Deschanel and New Girl. Like, that kind of, like,
which is interesting, because The French Dispatch has that. Like, it's a weird movie in that it's got elements of that twee. Because The French Dispatch is, like, three stories, I think.
Yeah, it is.
The one with Timothy Chalamet is
Timothée. We found out his name is.
It's
how embarrassing
for you. It's like there's some darkness in that one, which yeah. I think is like why it's considered, it's ranked so low compared to his other movies, because he kind of stepped out of the, there's some twee components,
yeah,
but the stories are much darker than normal, yeah. And I think that that's why it's like regarded so like
low. Well, that one also on takes place like right after war,
right?
So it's got that like heaviness to it.
Well, I mean, Moonrise Kingdom takes place during war. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's like bombs going off and shit.
There is like a really heavy component to Moonrise Kingdom, but again, it's because it's the kids and that like fantastical nature. I think it kind of.
But in French Dispatch, he doesn't shy away from like addressing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so dark and heavy as a like a subject matter. Granted, it's like again. Just a story and yeah. like it's all
yeah
fantasy. But he doesn't shy away from the imagery. And whereas Moonrise Kingdom has that like darkness, the underlying
yeah.
dark piece of it, but it's not at the forefront like it is on French Dispatch. And right. I think that that's like, you know, his movies are well known for being like fun and cutesy. And then to like all of a sudden like be abrupt and it be dark
yeah.
up front, I think is part of the reason people yeah. don't
gel with it.
Yeah. There's, I think, one more thing we haven't gotten to, at least.
Accidental Wes Anderson?
Accidental Wes Anderson. I love that account.
So
there's a book.
There is a book. So we were talking about, like, the symmetry of,
yep.
like, Wes Anderson's style. And that has created this, like, thing where it's, like, accidental Wes Anderson. And it's typically something that is, like, weirdly symmetrical.
Mm-hmm. Or like pastel yeah. and symmetrical, yeah. yeah.
And it's like Instagram account, yep. basically. And it's just images that are like kind of Wes Anderson-y.
I'm gonna go.
I'm literally looking for it right now. Accidentally Wes Anderson. They did make a book
yep.
of these.
Yeah, and it's like
there's actually an art exhibit in London right now.
Some of it's like this. There's this building that is very symmetrical. It has like some curved bits, and it has some like square bits and circles, and then it's like pastel. And it's like you look at it and you're like, oh yeah, that's accidental Wes Anderson.
Yeah. Or like
this one house.
Oh yeah.
It's like a bright yellow, but it's very symmetric and like aesthetically pleasing. And, like, there's hedges in the front. And you're like, that could be in Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah. Or, like, this phone that's in front of the mountains. Mm-hmm. Just, like, in the center.
Exactly. But, like, if you look at this. That's so funny. So, the Painted Ladies are on here.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody, turned them right side. And then when you turn them right side, it's very much accidental Wes Anderson.
They're sideways?
Well, no. When you, like, they go up.
Right.
So if you take the photo with your phone straight, they'll look like they're sideways.
Oh, I've never realized
because
that.
Because it's going up a hill.
Right.
But if you, like, orient your phone to the hill,
yeah.
they look straight.
Huh.
But if you're standing on the hill and you hold your phone straight,
they look,
like, at an angle.
Interesting. I guess I've never taken a photo of the Painted Ladies. I've just seen them.
Yeah.
Never thought about that. But yeah, if you straighten up, that is Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson went to San Francisco, and that's where this all started.
That's how he was inspired for his style. But I think it's fine. Just the fact that, like, as a society, we can look at things and say, like, oh, that's Wes Anderson.
Now cool. I want to go watch this new thing.
I do too. I don't think I have anything else.
No, I think this was a fun one to talk about just because we're both so such big fans of his movies.
Yeah. I really want to see that new one.
I do too.
My boy Deb. Gotta support him.
And I can't. Cucumber
Patch.
I was trying to think of another crazy way to say his name, but I don't have anything. Well, I don't have anything default. Better than Benadryl Cucumber Patch.
Yeah, that one's my default.
All right, so with that, please go on your favorite podcast streaming service and give us a 5-star rating. Listen through the song, and you can hear all of our social media and contact info. Hit us up there. Give us a follow. like our stuff. Tell us where we should go drink beer next.
Yep.
And we will see you next time.
Bye, guys.
You can follow along with all of our drunken shenanigans on Instagram at Drunken Uncultured.
You can also contact us via email at drunkenuncultured@gmail.com.
You can find me, Lindsay, on Instagram at LindsaySoldOut.
And you can find me, Stephanie, on Instagram at _StephanColor.